everyone, and welcome to Dolly's Fall 2021 podcast series. This is Jennifer Irvin. I am the managing editor of the Journal of Language and Literacy Education, which is a peer-reviewed, open-access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy at the University of Georgia. Today, I am speaking with Scott Jarvie, who's an assistant professor at San Jose State University. His manuscript is titled The Black Box, Close Reading, Literary Life. Thank you for joining me today, Scott. I look forward to hearing more about your work.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
All right. I want to start with a really interesting connection that you draw in your article between the spy character and the short story, The Black Box, which you're writing about, and the subversive moves that teachers make as we face demands for standardization and accountability. You mentioned teaching behind a closed door, maybe with a divergent agenda. And I think a lot of language arts teachers feel this need right now, especially with the current political climate amidst recent resolutions against teaching about systemic racism. I wonder if you can talk a little more about your own experience in the classroom. Did you have to teach behind closed doors? Were these pressures for accountability really high for you? How did you cope with them?
Sure. This is a great question. And I sat there and tried to think about it a little bit. And to be honest, I didn't have a ton of administrative pressure in my first 2 years, but it took me more than a year to realize that, I think, which says something about how we prepare teachers and the ways that we get them to think about teaching. I was really in the alternative certification program that I went through. I was really taught to focus on achievement and assessment. And I think that tended to narrow my curricular focus towards things that are really easily measurable and that can be, you know, can be produced by students on a performance assessment or something like that. But engaging more complex issues, important ones like the ones you named, like racism or politics, the kinds of things to which there aren't really easy answers. Those things weren't really a great fit for that teaching approach. Then I had to come to that stuff on my own. And I think it took some time to kind of realize that I did have the space behind that closed door to reimagine a curriculum that engaged with that more. And of course, I think that those are the kinds of things that art and literature are well suited at their best to dealing with, but somehow that focus can get crowded out a little bit. That was my initial job. My second job, I was teaching in Chicago at a higher performing high school where there was a pretty strong demand for students to be placed at like selective colleges. And so I felt pressure from parents there in conversations, emails, and, you know, other with colleagues and administrators to teach in a way that facilitated that successful college application. A lot of discussion about ACT scores, a lot of discussion about that, and to see kind of ways that that became a really substantial part of the curriculum in that space. I felt, you know, like I felt that pressure certainly. There was also a move to align instruction across course sections. I remember I taught a first year, a freshman writing course, and we had a common assessment, and there was like an administrative concern that students might be getting different kinds of instruction across different sections, which seems obvious and not a bad thing to me, right? You have different teachers, you're going to get different things, but that was seen as as undesirable. So then there was kind of a move to align it with common assessments and other things. I'll also say this kind of pressure, accountability pressure, and the ways that kind of narrow curriculum, that's something I see my teachers that I work with in California are dealing with a lot, whether there are in, you know, the public schools in the Bay Area where I work. And then, you know, we have several teacher candidates in charter contexts, and they feel that pressure a lot. And I think it's kind of exacerbated by the burnout of teaching in COVID too, right? Learning to teach is already an exhausting experience. And it seems to be even more so in the current, you know, climate that we're in. And then to feel that pressure on top of it has been really difficult for the teacher candidates I've talked to.
A lot of what you're saying is really resonating with both my experience and what I hear from our teacher candidates too. And that a lot of it is, like you're saying, like it's combined with that burnout from COVID. And a lot of it is interestingly like a felt constraint rather than an actual one. And it's that question of like, I'm just starting out, what can I do? And kind of being hesitant to like jump 2 feet in and starting slow because people just aren't sure. So yeah, I think it's interesting when we think about like what we can do to support teachers and feeling a little bit more freedom, but yeah.
You know, and there's things that I can do as a teacher educator. I can create assignments that do that. I can, as a mentor, I can talk to, we were just talking about this, right? Like the way that you advise people, like you can talk to them in ways that take them seriously, that treats them as intellectuals to have a contribution to make to curriculum and to what happens in schools. But I get frustrated with the feeling we've all had as teachers where you're not really being asked to do that. You know, you're asked to do what someone else has decided is the thing that needs to happen with yourself and your students in your particular classroom.
That's such a struggle. Okay. I want to ask you about, you made a comment in your article that there's no official curriculum meaningfully separate from the people in your classroom. And I think this is kind of what you're touching on now. And then suggest that English teachers would do well to consider that, the connection there between curriculum and the people that you're working with and what it means for their classrooms. Can you talk about how that's kind of informed some of your work as a teacher? And I feel like this kind of carries on from what you're talking about already.
Absolutely. You know, as an early career researcher, we try to find like through lines that connect our work. And my like the writing that I did in graduate school and in the first couple years of my work as a professor has been pretty eclectic and pretty disparate. But I think that this issue is one way that I would kind of tie those different threads together, thinking about how can we like humanize school spaces in a really general sense, right? And thinking about what are all the different threads, sort of like experiences, aspects of their identity that people bring with them into the space, right? So, you know, I started out really early on being really interested in the relationship between religion and education, having taught at religious schools and seeing the help and the harm that religion can do in school spaces. And seeing how important that is to people's identities too, right? So that's one aspect of, you know, something that people bring with them into the classroom that we don't think of as part of an official curriculum, but is something that certainly shapes what happens there and what people learn and the kinds of things that they say and write and do. So thinking about in terms of humanizing, the need to humanize the curriculum and the need to recognize that the official curriculum can be very dehumanizing too, right? It doesn't always, or even like, I would say primarily see students as persons so much as students, right? They're subjects, they're constructed in a particular way. And I want to try to resist that in my work as a teacher and a writer. And you know, that's not an original idea. I think a lot of people have been doing this work for a long time, right? Like work on relevant curriculum, on sustaining curriculum, particularly with students, with youth, right? Thinking about in an English context, like how can we bring in literacy practices that aren't a part of that official curriculum, but that are important to our students, that are, you know, are going to be part of the people they become in the future, right? So doing that, and then in the case of this article that we're talking about in particular, like thinking about how can we extend that to teachers as well? Like how can we acknowledge that teachers are people in the classroom, that they have something to contribute to the official curriculum? And I think that the more we can do that, the more we make teaching like a really complex and compelling and not just worthwhile work, but work that feels worthwhile for teachers, right? To which they have something to contribute as a person. And I worry that too much of a like a move towards just delivering curriculum is really kind of reductive work for teachers and makes it hard for them to feel like they're being humanized.
I wholeheartedly agree from my own experience. And I think that that's such an important thing for us to think about right now when we're losing so many teachers in the classroom. It's like, if we do want to bring them in and keep them there, I think what you're talking about is really essential in terms of like allowing them to do the work that is humanizing and that they can feel inspired by, as opposed to just that something that's prescribed to them. I'm going to jump ahead here to my fourth question, which is that there's something I really appreciated towards the end of your article, where you kind of troubled the idea of relevance with the text that we choose. And how sometimes when we choose a text that we might consider from coming from our own perspectives as relevant to students' identities, it ends up being kind of based on our own biases and our own understandings of those identities, especially if it's not one that we share. And you advocate instead for the possibility of resonance and finding connection across differences. And you argue that texts that resonate may actually lead to a more diverse curricula in ELA. How do we find that resonance? What does that look like in your work to seek that concept of resonance with students?
I don't know that there's a plan to get us to find it. I know that's a cop-out, right? And I'm not trying to cop out, but I am trying to be honest. What I would say is that we need to notice it when we, like after the fact, when we recognize that's what's going on, right? So being aware of when we find ourselves or our students drawn to things that surprise us, especially when that pull is unexpected, when it defies maybe pre-existing assumptions or stereotypes that we have about students or about ourselves. And, you know, and then notice that and think and talk and write about it and have it, allow it to potentially expand our our sense of the possible with respect to curriculum. You know, I know that's not a step-by-step helpful answer, but part of the like the thing that I want to say is that shortcuts have limited the ways that we can think about textual relevance or about the use of particular texts or the place of particular texts in classrooms. And, you know, we need to not always take those shortcuts too, right? We need to allow ourselves some sense of being able to be surprised. So being open to it and, you know, as always, like making space for a lot of diverse experiences in classrooms and you know, I use diverse in that word gets like coded as multicultural, and I certainly mean that, right? But diverse in the sense of diverging from the kinds of things that we might even expect would be relevant in a particular context to our students.
Yeah, thank you for that. Before we close out, I just want to ask you if you have any book recommendations for our listeners. Anything you're reading right now that you love?
Sure. I'm reading Matrix by Lauren Groff. It's a book that I just started recently. It's her new book. Really strange, lovely book. Historical fiction about a nun in the 12th century in France that kind of engages feminism and sexuality in the context of this kind of like really like cloistered religious environment, and kind of thinking about the relationship between those themes and history and memory and agency. But beautiful book, really enjoying it so far, and unlike anything I've read in a long time. The other one I really like is Appleseed by Matt Bell. Is a science fiction, like climate change horror book almost. Really, really ambitious, really like imaginative. There's mythology in it. There's kind of multiple science fiction storylines. There's kind of like stuff that feels very present about the sort of looming climate crisis, and then an imagination of what it looks like in 50 years, 100 years in the US. So just as a book that, like Matrix, is doing things I haven't really seen in a book before. Highly recommend that too. And the writing in both of them is so strong, right? I think, you know, plot aside in terms of, you know, what I can learn from it, just to see like incredibly talented writers who are able to do poetic things on every page. That's the kind of stuff that I want to try to push myself to read as much as I can. You know, it's not always easy as a teacher. I'm sure you know this, we all know this, right? To keep that reading up is difficult, but the more that I can, you know, the stronger I think my writing is and my teaching is. So that's what I'm reading right now.
That's great. Thank you so much for that. I've recently recommitted myself to reading for enjoyment. And I think it is really important in the work. Actually, I think it's making me a better thinker in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to close this out. Listeners, to read this manuscript, check out Dolly's fall 2021 issue, which will be published in early December 2021. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jennifer.